The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the NBC News. First of all, from RNS on April 22nd, an article by Catherine Papinster. Early Christian scripture and ancient codices draw collectors' eyes to Paris. London. Amid all the preparation to turn Paris into a venue for the Olympic Games that began in less than 100 days, one small corner of the French capital is preparing for another modern form of competition based in antiquity, Christie's auction of early Christian texts from North Africa. Some of the most important religious artifacts to come up for sale in recent years, the manuscripts from the privately owned Shorian collection, including the oldest complete version of the first epistle of Peter and the book of Jonah, were displayed in New York earlier this month and have arrived in Paris for inspection by prospective bidders. The auction sale of the works, written on papyrus in the Coptic language, will take place at Christie's in London in June. The viewings of the Shorian collection have drawn representatives from museums around the world, as well as private collectors. To some, they represent beauty, to others, links to the past, and to others, a connection with faith. This is one of the most important sales Christie's has ever had in this field, said Eugenio Donadani, senior specialist in medieval and Renaissance manuscripts at Christie's. They are touchstones helping us understand the history of Christianity. The Shorian collection is the work of Martin Shorian, building on the collections of his father, and now comprises 20,000 manuscripts, including 40 linked to the Bible. Now in his 80s, Shorian has decided to sell part of it, including the most important artifacts. According to Donadani, the Crosby-Shorian Codex, valued at about $3.7 million, is thought to be the world's oldest book in private hands, comprising, besides Peter's epistle and the story of Jonah, part of the Book of Maccabees and an Easter homily. It is highly significant in the history of writing, said Donadani, because it marks a pivotal moment. It is the transition from scrolls to codicils as Christianity spread across the Mediterranean. But the codex also shows the religious pivot going on at the time. It is thought that the codex was used by a monastery in Upper Egypt around the middle of the 3rd century CE. Before the Council of Nicaea in 325, which tried to secure consensus on issues of Christian belief, such as the relationship between God the Father and God the Son, and the latter's divine nature. You can see from the Codex that they are finding their feet as Christians, said Donadani. They are steeped in Jewish tradition and are shaping the new religion. The book is so old that it calls the text now known as the First Epistle of Peter, the Letter of Peter, as if they are not aware a further letter exists. Another major manuscript going up for sale on June 11 is the Codex Sinaiticus Rescriptus, which is in effect an ancient effort at recycling. In the 10th century, John Zosimos, a monk at the monastery near Jerusalem, acquired a document written on expensive vellum, which he packed up and took to St. Catherine's Monastery in the Sinai Desert to reuse for his own writing. The original writing, itself the earliest surviving piece of the Gospels to be written in Aramaic, dating from the 5th or 6th century, is still visible. The underlying text was not scrubbed out very well, so under fluorescent lighting, you can still see it, written in the language that Jesus himself would have spoken, said Donadani. The document, valued at $1.85 million, is a bargain, as the buyer gets the two texts for the price of one. Also part of the Schoen collection is the Holkham Hebrew Bible, a Sephardic manuscript in Hebrew from the 13th century, the Gerards Bergen Bible from the late 12th century Flanders, and a commentary on the Gospels by the Venerable Bede from the 11th century. Last year, the Codex Sassoon, a Hebrew Bible more than 1,000 years old, became the most valuable manuscript sold at auction. When it went for $38.1 million at Sotheby's in New York, confirming New York as the leading market for Hebraic religious text, while London remains the capital for sales of illuminated Christian text. But both centers attract buyers, including museums, from around the world. Prices are believed to have been pushed higher by the intervention of one major player, the Green family, U.S. evangelical Christians, who have used their fortune created by the Hobby Lobby chain of craft stores to purchase illuminated or decorated manuscripts, Torahs, papyri, and other works worth $20 million to $40 million from auction houses, dealers, private collectors, and institutions. Items from the Green Collection were donated to the Museum of the Bible in Washington, a family project that opened in 2017, with a mission to inspire confidence in the absolute authority and reliability of the Bible. It has since stepped back from this evangelical purpose and says that it is an institution whose purpose is to invite all people to engage with the transformative power of the Bible. Meanwhile, the Faith and Liberty Discovery Center, a Bible museum created by the American Bible Society in Philadelphia, announced that it will shut its doors after fewer than 3 years of operation and an investment of $60 million. Opened in the wake of COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns, it failed to draw anywhere close to its projected 250,000 annual visitors. The British and Foreign Bible Society, which has the biggest collection of Bibles and other religious books and documents in the world, has shied away from opening a museum, although it does open its collection, based at Cambridge University, to scholars and researchers. While it still expands through legacies and donations and is committed to a good stewardship of its existing treasures, the BFBS does not acquire items with its own funds, preferring, it says, to disseminate the Bible and be involved in mission rather than convey the message that the Bible is a museum piece. In recent times, there have been concerns that some items held by biblical manuscript collectors have been acquired through the black market, especially from people in trouble spots in the Middle East. According to Christie's Donna Donnie, all the items from the Schoen collection that are up for auction in June have had their provenance vetted and have been checked extensively by its legal department. Now an article from the NBC News entitled, House Bill Aims to Condemn Hindu-Phobia, but Draws Concerns from Progressive Groups, by Sakshi Venkataman. A new piece of legislation introduced in the House of Representatives aims to condemn Hindu-Phobia, a term used by some Hindu Americans to describe what they say are burgeoning anti-Hindu sentiments in the U.S. The bill was introduced by Democratic Representative Shri Thandar, an Indian American from Michigan. At a news conference, he described what he feels is a growing threat to Indian Americans who practice Hinduism, the world's third largest religion. Today, I am seeing in the U.S. a substantial increase of attacks on Hinduism. A lot of misinformation being circulated, he said. Having practiced Hinduism, having grown in a Hindu household, I know what Hinduism is. It is a very peaceful religion. It is not a religion that attacks others. It is not a religion that is aggressive against others. Thendar's resolution enumerates several points, including that the House celebrates the contributions of Hindus to the U.S. and condemns Hindu phobia and anti-Hindu bigotry. But progressive Hindu and South Asian groups are expressing concern about the legislation, saying that while anti-Hinduism sentiment does exist, the term Hindu phobia was invented by the Indian far right to shut down criticism of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government. In many cases, instances of anti-Indian sentiment, general xenophobia, or even mistaken Islamophobia are misleadingly labeled as Hindu phobic, regardless of whether or not there's any evidence to support claims of religious motivation. Hindus for Human Rights, a progressive civil rights organization, said. Even worse, claims of Hindu phobia have routinely been weaponized to smear people, including self-identifying Hindus who criticize the current Indian government. At his news conference, Thendar described the Hindu community as inclusive and said it's been deliberately misrepresented by mainstream media. He also said Hindu places of worship have been targeted, referring to instances of graffiti on two California Hindu temples, reading, "Modi is a terrorist," and including slogans that call for an independent Sikh state. We have experienced substantially more events of this kind in recent months, and I have a feeling that this is just the beginning, he said. This is just the beginning of a very coordinated attempt against this community. Thendar said he doesn't want to speculate about who is behind these attacks, but wants the FBI, the Department of Justice, and local authorities to get involved. Modi's government is often criticized for its record on human rights, including attacks on the media and anti-Muslim legislation. It has also been credited with propagating Hindu nationalism, both in India and the diaspora. In the U.S., Muslims and caste minorities have reported facing targeted attacks and violence for speaking out against far-right Hindu nationalist actors that claim to make India a Hindu-dominated nation. Hindus for Human Rights said in its release that Thendar's resolution could shut down those conversations by painting them as Hindu phobic. Really? The organization said, the core threat to Indian American immigrants in the U.S. is white nationalism. Though it claims to celebrate Hindu Americans and speak for our community's interest, this resolution does not respond to real concern about how Hindu Americans are affected by white Christian nationalism in the U.S., the release said. Instead, it reflects a long-standing effort by the Hindu supremacist movement in the U.S. to divide South Asian communities. Now an opinion piece written by Ferez Abraham, a Palestinian-American who is the CEO of Levant Ministries, published by the Religion News Service on April 23. Christians must confront the weaponization of a sacred promise. In a House Education Committee hearing on April 19 on antisemitism on campus, U.S. Representative Rick Allen, a Republican from Georgia, used a passage from the book of Genesis to intimidate the president of Columbia University, insisting that American universities teach their students about what will happen under the wrath of God if they do not support Israel. Allen grossly misappropriated the 12th chapter of Genesis, in which God tells Abraham, who will be the father of the Israelites, I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. At one point, Allen asked the Egyptian-born President Nemat Shafik, do you want Columbia University to be cursed by God? His question not only implied divine judgment against Columbia, but also overstepped his legislative role. Undoubtedly, anti-Semitism is a horrific prejudice that has led to appalling atrocities. It must be condemned, not only at universities, but wherever it is found. And I commend the House Committee for its efforts to address the issue. However, I strongly condemn the use of the Bible as a tool for shaping U.S. policy or for suppressing civil political debate in academic settings. When political Christians like Allen claim divine approval for their ideologies or views, they engage in what can be described as spiritual terrorism, using biblical texts to instill fear among non-Christians. This fundamentally contradicts our Christian faith. Growing up in the West Bank, I often saw evangelical leaders deploying the ancient words of Genesis in support of the modern state of Israel. This conflation created serious confusion for me as a Christian Palestinian. Though an expression of love for the Jewish people, their quotation of Genesis approved of a secular state that imposed oppressive military law on my family and severely restricted my access to churches in Jerusalem and other holy sites. Israel unjustly prevented my wife, born in Gaza, from legally residing in the West Bank, and hindered my wife and me from pursuing our desire to launch a ministry in Bethlehem. Many theologians and Christian scholars have addressed the issue of Genesis 12:3. In Christian readings, the blessings promised to Abraham are fulfilled through Christ's sacrifice, as the Apostle Paul teaches in his letter to the Galatians. And Jesus, the one and true seed of Abraham, embodies the ultimate realization of these blessings. To enjoy the Abrahamic blessings, we abide in Christ's redemptive work rather than blindly support geopolitical strategies. The harsh reality of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank did not deter me from pursuing my God-given dream. Guided by a vision to share the gospel, I founded Levant Ministries, dedicated to sharing God's love throughout the Middle East. On April 12, near Alexandria, the birthplace of Dr. Shafik, I addressed more than 6,000 evangelical Christians from some 300-plus churches across Egypt and other Arab countries at a prayer conference led by my dear friend, Pastor Sammy Lawrence Maurice. In my address, I highlighted the plight of Christians in Gaza, including members of my wife's family who are still sheltering at two churches in Gaza. I also consoled Palestinian families mourning the immense loss of more than 34,000 lives, predominantly women and children. Similarly, I extended my prayers for the innocent Jewish victims of the October 7 attacks, emphasizing that the overwhelming majority of people in the Middle East are not anti-Semitic. On the contrary, we seek to live in peace with their Jewish and Muslim neighbors, striving to ensure justice for all. As a Christian leader serving across the Middle East, I am principally guided by the example of the Jewish Messiah, who consistently challenged misguided theological frameworks and denounced spiritual terrorism throughout the ministry. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus condemned the idea of violent retaliation for disbelief, even among his own disciples, during an incident when the Samaritans denied him entry into their territories. When his disciples James and John suggested a deadly punishment, calling down fire from heaven to consume the Samaritans, Jesus sharply rebuked them. He firmly dismissed any notion of divine justice. This response underscores Jesus' approach to overcoming prejudice and animosity through reconciliation, rather than through vengeance and violence. As followers of Christ, we must adopt this attitude of grace. It's important to recognize that God's promise to Abraham extended far beyond a mere strip of land. Manipulating Scripture to advance political agendas under the guise of divine wrath is a betrayal of our biblical core values. By embodying the grace that Jesus showed to all, including his adversaries, we honor our commitment to God in a world plagued by animosity and strife. This is our sacred calling as followers of Christ, a solemn responsibility we must fulfill as we live out our faith in a broken and divided world. Now an excerpt from an article published by RNS on April 23, written by Catherine Post and Madeline McCrae, entitled Taylor Swift's TTPD, Religious Imagery for a Spiritually Syncretic Era. When pop star icon Taylor Swift disclosed her religion in the 2020 Netflix documentary Miss America, she was unambiguous. I live in Tennessee. I'm a Christian. That's not what we stand for, she said in 2018 in response to Tennessee Republican Marsha Blackburn's opposition to the Violence Against Women Act and LGBTQ rights. But these days, Swift's faith appears more fluid. Her religious references are as eclectic as a Brooklyn thrift shop. Well-worn Christian metaphors sit alongside a more bohemian mishmash of witchcraft, divination, and paganism. Her newest release, The Tortured Poets Department, is a patchwork of religious allusions from Good Samaritans and Jehovah's Witnesses to altar sacrifices and prophecies. Whatever her personal beliefs, the syncretism displayed in the sprawling 31-song double album, which racked up 300 million listens in 24 hours, making it Spotify's most streamed album in one day, is emblematic of the religious mishmash of millennial and Generation Z religion writ large. These days, roughly 28% of U.S. adults identify as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. And a 2021 survey from the Springtide Research Institute showed that 51% of its sample population of 13 to 25-year-olds use tarot cards or engage in fortune-telling. Swift knows her audience, and she knows they're dabbling in everything from spells to astrology. Her genius has always been to make common cause with the curiosities, heartbreaks, and longings of her listeners. And no doubt, the inherent feminism of Wicca appeals to Swift and Swifties alike. Christianity may no longer be the primary faith framework for her songs, but Swift's strict moral system remains in TTPD, punishing bad boyfriends and finger-wagging church ladies while celebrating her own metaphorical resurrections, be it from crucifixion or witch-burning. Here's how religion features in Swift's newest contribution to her expanding canon, Christianity. While many of Swift's early references to Christianity and religion follow a traditional good versus evil binary, references in TTPD critique Christian hypocrisy and grapple with existential questions about the nature of guilt and sin. When Swift sings about dating a wild boy in But Daddy, I Love Him, she sarcastically calls on God to save the most judgmental creeps and dismisses the Sarahs and Hannahs in their Sunday best who only try to save the people they hate. Similar themes show up in I Can Fix Him, No Really, I Can, which fans speculate is about Matt Healy, lead singer of the band 1975. Swift describes how people shake their heads at her relationship and say, "God help her." But she tells the doubters that your good Lord doesn't need to lift a finger, because she, and she alone, can turn this dangerous man into an angel. In Cassandra, Swift continues to call out judgmental Christians. She condemns the Christian chorus line, who never spared a prayer for my soul, and invokes the Gospel of John with the line, "When the first stone's thrown, they're screaming." In John 8, Jesus tells religious leaders about to stone a woman caught in adultery that anyone without sin should be the first to throw a stone at her. With the ninth track on the album, Guilty as Sin, Swift blurs traditional boundaries between sin and sainthood as she daydreams about her lover. "What if I roll the stone away? They're going to crucify me anyway," Swift sings. "But if the way you hold me is actually what's holy?" By the song's conclusion, she chooses you and me religiously. Swift also tinkers with the themes of sin in The Prophecy, where she flips the script on the biblical narrative of the Garden of Eden. "I got cursed like Eve got bitten. Oh, was it punishment?" Rather than depicting Eve as causing sin to enter the world via the forbidden fruit, Swift declares that Eve got bitten, implying that Eve had limited agency in the sin-causing scenario. Swift describes herself as another victim of fate who got cursed and wants to redo the prophecy. Swift's eclectic nods to religion don't end there. In The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived, Swift incredulously describes an ex as having gazed at her starry-eyed in his Jehovah's Witness suit, a nod to the formal attire worn by Jehovah's Witnesses as they go door to door to share their faith. Swift also incorporates angel-devil imagery in The Albatross, and in The Prophecy, allusions to cards on the table and spending money. "So someone will tell me it'll be okay." We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you will listen again next time. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.